I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Martin Luther King Jr. advocated using the techniques of civil disobedience, nonviolence, and dialogue to advance the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s. King is still held in high regard by many for that approach. Today, his oldest son, Martin Luther King III, is carrying on his father's famous message. This week on Intersection, I talk with Martin Luther King III about the state of his father's legacy, but also about the application of those ideals to Florida's recent experience with the Trayvon Martin killing. We also talk about the state of race relations in America after Barack Obama, the country's first black president, was reelected this month. That conversation ahead on Intersection. I spoke with Martin Luther King III last week. Martin Luther King III is the oldest son of the famous civil rights leader. King has carried on his father's cause, and he joins me now to discuss civil rights in the 21st century. Martin Luther King III, very nice to speak with you.
Honored to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
Your father advocated nonviolent civil disobedience as a way of advancing civil rights for African Americans. And we're speaking to you as you're on a speaking trip in Central Florida, headed to Rollins College to deliver an address called Continuing the Legacy. What do you think is the state of your father's message today?
Well, I would start by stating that my father talked about one of the major things he talked about was eradicating something that he called the triple evils. And he said those triple evils were many of our problems could be categorized under one of those evils. He said they were poverty, racism, and militarism. And he wanted to figure out how we could eradicate poverty, how we could get rid of racism in our society, and how we could at least live in a more civil and just society that did not operate from a strength perspective of you having to use or utilize using so many resources for militarism. Now, if you look at those three things, clearly we've made significant strides around the issue of race. We obviously are not there yet. When you hear, you wonder, and this may not be the notion, but you do wonder when we have an election. We just, of course, had the presidential election, and there are states that are talking about seceding from the United States because of the leadership. You just wonder, what is that really about? Then there are people, I have people, friends, who are teachers in schools. And I could, all day long, I could maybe come up with reasons and say, this political candidate, I disagree with his or her philosophy. But there are a number of students, particularly in the South, but not just in the South, who basically say they hate Obama. They don't know why, but they hate him. So I just, you wonder what that's about. I have no problem with you saying, look, I disagree with these policies, and this is the problem I have, and that makes sense to me. Now, all I'm saying is we are a divided country today.
Can I ask, how much of that do you think is bluster and rhetoric versus true deep-down hatred?
Well, I don't know.
Or being serious about seceding from the Union.
Well, the seceding, I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, I think the fact that 30 states are talking about it, and even a few of them, a number of them have acquired a number of signatures so that a petition has to be looked at. Now, I wasn't quite finished. Not so much with that particular issue. I just wanted to put it out there to say that we still have some issues around race that we have to overcome. But as it relates to poverty and militarism, I don't see that we've made much progress at all. In other words, you know, we've got a significant number of Americans now who are living in poverty, some who were at one time middle class. And because of the foreclosure crisis, they're thrust back into poverty. And so we got to find a way to come together as a nation to create the climate for entrepreneurship and small businesses to succeed or to be successful, so that more jobs can be created and we ultimately can begin to address the issue of poverty. And then the final thing, militarism. We spend a huge amount of money on machinery and weapons that we hopefully we'll never have to use. If we do use them, then we can all kiss it goodbye. So I guess my point is we've got a lot of work to do here and around the world because people are constantly engaged in conflict. And my dad tried to teach how we could learn live together without destroying either person or property.
Do you think, though, is it harder to get that message out today than it was for your father in the 1960s, given the changes in the way media is approached and in terms of people being able to choose their own outlet on the internet and that sort of thing, whereas before, major networks were definitely carrying civil rights disobedience actions that were being taken. Is it harder to get that message out?
Theoretically, it should be easier.
You would think
because of the medians that exist in theory, but the other side of the coin is there are so many, as you've stated, that it's very hard to penetrate society because you don't know exactly where. Now I think that at some point, as social media continues to grow and become more defined. I don't know exactly what I mean when I'm saying this, but I do think that at some point it's going to clearly become much easier because you'll be able to target not just one outlet. Like, you know, if we were using tweets, if we had everyone tweeting about how are we going to create a peaceful society, if we had everyone embracing their Facebook pages and say, I want to create peace in our world, some kind of campaign that everyone can get engaged in. Then we're moving in the right direction. And then if we had our, even Hollywood, part of our problem, in my judgment, is we consume a diet of violence. We have to learn to create a culture of nonviolence if we're going to even begin to address the issues that impact our society. And when you look at the fact that 6 out of 10 cartoons are violent, 6 out of 10 movies on television are violent, 7 out of 10 video games are violent. We are constantly inundated with violence. And so until we as consumers begin to say, okay, I want to consume a different diet, and I would command or demand, in a sense, you can't make, but certainly you could not patronize or use. There are certain movies that we could say we're not going to go participate in that. And when those movies stop making money, then Hollywood will say, okay, we're going to make a better product.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Martin Luther King III. He is the oldest son of Martin Luther King Jr. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Mark Simpson. You can tell us what you think about civil rights in America today online, Facebook or Twitter. Send an email to intersection@WMFE.org. The United States, of course, just reelected its first black president after a tough campaign that did reveal divides in the nation. And I wonder, what do you think the 2012 presidential campaign and election illustrate in the U.S. when it comes to those issues of civil rights?
Well, what I think is what the president did was he and the administration came out for a position of marriage equality, which divided the nation. Quite frankly, as a Christian, I personally may have concerns about it. But if I was an elected official representing Americans, I would have to come down probably with the position of the president, because I do think you can't mistreat one group against another. At least you shouldn't. I think that immigration, for example, is a huge issue, and we still have not come up with a policy that is sensitive around immigration issues. I hope that now the Senate and the House and the administration will come up with a human policy around immigration. I think that when it comes to, health care, that issue is already resolved, and maybe it needs to be tweaked so that the concerns that those that companies have about the cost for them can be addressed and I don't know what the answer is, but perhaps there is some tweaking that could occur because healthcare is real now.
Is there one of those issues that you think rises to the top in terms of urgency in needing addressing?
To me, the most urgent issue is not even those issues. Those are all imperative and important and must be addressed. But the most important issue is continuing to create growth in the economy and create the climate for jobs to be available. Because that's the only way that, I mean, this nation has to be competitive. We've got huge infrastructure projects that need to be done. And we've got to get those financed, and that will put people back to work. I mean, there are a number of things from a new technology standpoint that we've got to do. But if we don't have a trained workforce, which is part of the problem, we're going to miss the mark. We won't be able to import enough of a workforce, particularly with the particular immigration policies today. So, therefore, we've got to look to the future and figure out how do we change our system of education so that we are retooling those youngsters who will be coming out of our schools.
So are you necessarily, if I follow you, it sounds like you're not necessarily framing job creation in a civil rights lens, but that these are all interconnected.
Yes. I wouldn't say that it's a civil rights issue per se. To me, that's more of a human rights issue, in fact. I think there are five things that, you know, many people would hope that they can have. One of those, not necessarily in this order, is the best education. All Americans should be allowed to have the best. If we're going to have a public education system, it ought to be the best in the world. We have the ability to create that. And so everyone ought to have the best public education. Everyone ought to be able to have a decent home, And when I say a decent home, I don't necessarily mean a $500 million home. Some people may have those. Some may have a $10 million home. But everyone ought to be able to have a decent home in this country. Everyone ought to be able to have some kind of health care in this country. Everyone ought to be able to have, justice. And there's a fifth one that I'm missing now. But those, I think these are all things that in our society, that every person should be available as an option, and they are not. I mean, you know, jobs is probably the biggest issue for most people. I mean, I know people who've been looking for 4 years, and job creation. So that's why I say we've got to retool ourselves. Whatever climate that needs to be created so the jobs can be available is what needs to happen immediately. Congress and the president must come together and must work to foster a spirit of cooperation so that the American people benefit.
Let me ask you about the term post-racial society. When President Obama was first elected, there was a lot of discussion about whether or not America had entered a post-racial society. And I wonder, what is your view on that statement, both when President Obama was first elected and I hear less discussion about that now. And so what do you think in terms of what's changed and what's been achieved, what hasn't been achieved?
Well, you know, I think that we are moving in the right direction, but I don't know that we are truly post-racial yet. And I say that because there still is a lot of discriminatory activity that goes on, whether it's with African Americans, whether it's with immigrants or Latinos and Hispanics. I mean, there's just a lot that still is happening that should not. When we no longer have some of those incidents, there's more hatred, more people are joining these groups, the neo-Nazi and hate groups, and people deciding they're going to arm themselves and go to their homes and go into their own communities. And that's, to me, that's counterproductive. So I don't know that we've yet achieved a post-racial. I do think we are moving in the right direction, but I don't think we're there yet.
Do you think that the election of President Obama moved that dialogue forward by
absolutely.
A significant degree?
No question. No question. It certainly moved it significantly. But here's what I'm one of the things that I what I think has probably is documented, even though they don't talk about it much. The threat level for President Obama compared to President Bush went up like 400%. And there's no reason why it should that should happen. I mean, all presidents, unfortunately, get threats. That's just the nature of the world. But for it to go up that much is frightening. And I don't know. I think even after this election, probably the threat level, they won't tell us because they, you know, Secret Service has to want to keep that information, you know, kind of quiet. But by the same token, every now and then information comes out. And so because of the division in the country right now, there's still a lot of hostility. Now, we'll get past that. We are a great nation. You know, you never know what's going to create it. I mean, and what I mean by that is out of our tragic situations like Sandy or many hurricanes that have occurred here in Florida and around the country, Americans are always, we forget about it. Who we are religiously, who we are racially, we roll up our sleeves and we want to help when we see people in trouble. That's the best of who we are, quite frankly. And that's it. You don't want to live in crisis to kind of create that condition. But unfortunately, a crisis does create the kind of a better scenario for unity. And for at least a moment, we stop focusing on whatever narrowly causes us to, want to have anger against someone, because you know, we can all relate to the misery of a human being may have to go through a process of a tragedy. So my point is, God forbid, hopefully we won't have to experience another Sandy, but hopefully something's got to come along to bring us together as a nation and to continue to bring out that best of who we are.
My guest is Martin Luther King III. You're listening to Intersection. I'm Mark Simpson. Speaking about unity, there was a moment several months back when it seemed like a lot of Floridians united. That was over the shooting of Trayvon Martin and by that neighborhood watchman, George Zimmerman. And we saw a lot of rallies, strong support coming out in Central Florida communities wanting to bond together. There was also a lot of anger. Sure. In those rallies. You were among civil rights leaders who addressed a rally at Sanford that drew hundreds and the aftermath of the shooting. I wonder, what was your reaction to the way that event unfolded in terms of seeing it in the community? And what do you think in terms of where that dialogue is today?
Well, I think that was a demonstration of civil disobedience where people came together in a nonviolent way and protested. And ultimately, the system of justice, at least initially, has done something that says that it's working. None of us know enough about the facts of the case to truly know all the specifics of what happened. But based on what had been heard, it seemed strange that a person, i.e., George Zimmerman, who certainly has stated that he did kill Trayvon Martin, could kill a young man who was visiting visiting his father, in fact, who lived on that property. It was a difficult period. And, at the end of the day, it is my hope that the family receives some level of justice. But the whatever the system speaks is what people, I think, have to accept. And what I mean by that is if George Zimmerman is found guilty, then, I think people would be at least feel some level of not vindication, because that's not the right word, but that some level of justice has been done. But if he's not, I don't know how that's going to be taken.
Do you think that situation in Sanford and the feeling of perhaps being left out of the justice process, or at least not having the justice process served in the way the community felt was appropriate, do you think that those feelings are unique to Sanford, or are there commonalities across the U.S.? Is that a situation unique to this community in Florida?
No, it is. It's throughout the nation. Certainly, I would say, and I would assume in the Latino and Hispanic community as well, but certainly African-American communities, in this context, it was not usually it's the police who, and it doesn't matter if the police are black or white. It's just the police and how they interact with young African-Americans or African-Americans in general. I think that whole tension, the whole perception that when a young African-American comes to a particular environment, he or she may be up to, I mean, there's a perception that he or she is up to no good. And that is, that in some cases that may be true, but in other cases it's not. And so it is a stigma that exists and a feeling. I mean, it's thick enough to cut with a knife in communities. People feel this in communities, and young people are constantly targeted in all over America. I mean, in New York, for example, city, there's a policy called Stop and Frisk, where they stopped almost 700,000 folks, most of them blacks and Latinos. And of those that they stopped, less than 5% were able to stop frisk them to determine if they had weapons, and less than 5% yielded anything. Now, the city was saying that this is a policy that really New York's crime is down and it's keeping the streets safe, maybe because of the perception. But the reality is, if that many people, if you told me you had a 50% or even a 30% of those who were stopped, you know, I would say, okay, you probably need to, even though I fundamentally have challenges with it, you may need to keep doing this. But when you have less than 5% of the folks who are being targeted, who you're stopping just because they are walking down the street or something. Now my point is, there's things like that happening all across America. Mm-hmm. And again, I think the way you address that is through in communities as well as with police departments. We need human relations sensitivity and diversity training. When police departments are exposed to human relations diversity and sensitivity, then at least you have a different perspective and you may look at things differently.
I want to ask you about your father. You were 10 years old when he was assassinated. What do you remember of him? Mm-hmm.
Well, I had the opportunity to travel with him, I guess, 8 or 10 times. And so I saw him in the context of his work, my brother and I. I saw him often in our home. All of us would see him because he would bring various people to our home. Sometimes it was entertainers. Sometimes it was just a reporter. Sometimes it was students who were involved in movement activity. Others who were involved in the movement, like Congressman John Lewis, like Julian Bond, who used to be the chairperson of the NAACP, any number of people, like Stokely Carmichael, who was an activist, you know, were in and out of our home all the time. So I remember quite vividly my dad and his people he worked with as well, Ambassador Andrew Young, Reverend Jose Williams. I mean, just a number of folks who were in and out of our home all the time. But I also remember that while he didn't have a large quantity of time with us because he traveled extensively, his quality when he spent with us as kids, he was like a playmate for us. I mean, he'd come home and toss the football. We'd go to the YMCA where he'd swim, and he taught us how to swim, and he'd get a massage. We would ride bicycles, those kind of things that we will. I mean, I'll always remember those wonderful experiences that we had with my dad.
Mm-hmm. Your father, of course, was active in Florida. He was famously arrested in St. Augustine. Mm-hmm. 1964 for refusing to leave a restaurant. At that time, of course, the city was the site of regular civil rights demonstrations. Do you have a sense of whether or not that experience in St. Augustine was different than more famous locales in the civil rights movement in the South, like Selma, Alabama, and Jackson, Mississippi. Was the Florida experience different?
You know, I don't know that. I would have to, since Ambassador Young was involved in that, I would have to ask him, and I will ask him. I'm not sure that you could differentiate each experience, because Albany, Georgia, or Birmingham, I mean, you know, where you had 3,000 kids arrested. In St. Augustine, I remember the policemen, I was told, were policemen by day and Klansmen at night. And so, but I don't think that was any different than any other community. I don't know that. I could be wrong. It could be. There certainly are defining moments and differentiating pieces of information from city to city. But I really couldn't tell you what that was as it related to St. Augustine.
You know, your father's legacy and image received a lot of attention when the monument opened up on mm-hmm. the Mall. There was some dispute about that in terms of the artist who created the inscription on the monument, what mm-hmm. did it actually look like. What do you think about the status of your father's legacy in terms of these issues that crop up periodically, and there seems to be kind of a re-editing of the view of Martin Luther King Jr.?
Well, I don't know that any of those issues really change. I mean, Dad and his team made their contribution to the nation and the world, and I'm not sure that there's a whole lot that could dramatically change what that represents to people. And the real issue is around hope, hope and inspiration. The movement inspire every major movement, whether it was the women's movement, whether it was, you know, the gay and lesbian movement. There are many movements in Tiananmen Square in China. When young people were demonstrating, they were inspired by the modern civil rights movement. So a lot of things have derived inspiration, the environmental movement from the modern civil rights movement. So I don't know that ever changes. I just think that these are just human issues that come up, and people will have various opinions. But I think that his real contribution is etched in history.
I've been speaking with Martin Luther King III. He is the oldest son of famous civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. It's been very nice speaking with you.
Thank you for the opportunity. Enjoyed it.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at WMFE.org/intersection. There you can listen back to previous episodes, and you can sign up for our weekly podcast. You can always reach us through WMFE's Facebook page and on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. The assistant producer is Amy Green. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.